Blog Talk Radio.
And good evening. Welcome to another edition of Fire and Training. I'm your host, Douglas Klein, and joining me tonight is Chief Les Stevens from out in Texas. And we're really excited about what we're going to talk about tonight on the show. And, you know, we got to thank our sponsors that allow us to do fire and training on Fire Engineering Blog Talk Radio. First of all, a big shout out to the folks at Penwell and Fire Engineering and Bobby Halton, who lets us have the opportunity to be on Blog Talk Radio with Fire Engineering. And, you know, honestly, right now Honeywell is just kicking it up. And if you're wanting to go to FDIC, there's opportunities for scholarships that they have. You got to put in and apply for it. Get, you know, that stuff in. It's happening every month, and most people don't realize it's every month. So, you know, check out the stuff on FDIC.com and go there and check out the opportunities for a scholarship. And we especially thank Honeywell for all of what they do for FDIC and for Blog Talk Radio and Fire Engineering. We're super excited about that. But we're going to jump head first into the night. I am extremely excited to say that I've got a good friend and colleague that is joining me tonight. We had the opportunity to meet a number of years ago at a great place called the National Fire Academy. And we just happened to be at dinner time and were eating at the Odd House and enjoying some great company of fire service professionals from all over the United States. And this gentleman was at the table, and we began conversing. He was in his first year of the Executive Fire Officer Program, and they were up to the point they were talking about what they were going to do for their first project. And, of course, you know, that's a pretty daunting task. First of all, going to the Executive Fire Officer Program, it's a very big honor and a privilege to do that. But when you start taking on your research project, it's a very serious time period, and you want to take on what effect your organization and how to make change. That's the whole purpose of developing, you know, executively within the organization. And Les Stevens, Chief Stevens, was there, and we were conversing and was talking about a topic that involved commercial buildings and how we tactically operate and the lack of some of the knowledge that's associated with that. And he began looking at tactics and deployment and training that's associated to that. And he actually had an opportunity and did the paper. But let me introduce this 29-year veteran of the fire service to you, Chief Les Stevens. He's out in San Marcos, Texas, where he's been there for 8 years. Hard to believe he's been there for 8 years, but he comes by way of Garland, Texas Fire Department, where he was at for 18 years, and he's certified as a master firefighter, a fire officer 4, a fire instructor 3, he's taught and functioned as a training officer. He's taught at several of the fire science programs. Collin College Fire Science Program is one of them. He's worked with the Dallas Fire Rescue Recruit Academy, Texas A&M, and the Municipal Fire School. And he took this EFL program and turned it into a great training piece that he started doing at FDIC. I had the honor and the privilege of being in the room when he did his first presentation. He did a stellar performance and continues to share that information, has branched out into a topic we're going to talk about tonight, which is chief officer development and how you get to where you want to be. But he also has an associate's degree in fire protection from Tarrant County College. He's a graduate, like I said, of the EFO program from the National Fire Academy. He's also a certified public manager and an accredited fire officer, a chief fire officer, and he graduated from Texas State University with a bachelor's degree in 2017. Congratulations, and help me welcome to the show my good friend and colleague, fellow instructor at FDIC, a fellow chief officer, and most of all, a good, good friend, Les Stevens. Les, welcome on the show.
Man, thanks. Thanks for having me, Chief. It's good to be here, and I appreciate all the kind words. Mostly, I appreciate the encouragement on that first EFO paper. That was a pretty daunting task, and you know, I wanted to do something that that was worthwhile, something that that wouldn't just impact, you know, myself and my department, but maybe hopefully be beneficial to others. And I think you know, putting our heads together and getting some input from a few other folks, we were able to accomplish that. So I appreciate that very much.
Well, you're quite welcome. But you know, that's what you do, and the National Fire Academy is not any place that you would not expect to have that type of conversation and dialogue to occur, and to be with, you know, a tremendous amount of knowledge and experience sitting around the table having some great conversations. Tonight, we're going to talk, first of all, about some current issues that's going on across the United States that many, many people are dealing with or are faced with dealing with in the very near future. And we're talking about emergency responses to these large storms and hurricanes. And tell us a little bit about what's going on in Texas and how you were affected, but also take us down closer to the coast. I know you're back a little bit, and talk about some of the things that you know are happening there.
Absolutely, yeah. You know, first off, our thoughts go out to those directly impacted by these storms, the people that have lost their homes, and even those who have lost loved ones here to Hurricane Harvey. And then our thoughts are still with our first responders. Here in Texas, we had over 600 firefighters deployed from Corpus Christi all the way to the Louisiana state line, you know, successfully completed thousands of rescues, had dozens of building fires in the time that we were dealing with that. The official stats from our state mutual aid program aren't out yet, but we had somewhere around 100 engines, 80 boat crews, just with our TIFMAS, which is our Texas Interstate Fire Mutual Aid System, TIFMAS deployment. That doesn't include the resources from Texas Task Force 1 and Texas Task Force 2, which are our USAR teams, and then the USAR teams from almost every other state in the nation that had one responded as well. So, man, it's been a big event, and, you know, I'm really proud of how well our state and the other states have pulled together resources to respond to it, and it looks like we're going to just barely have an opportunity to get reset and then hopefully head over and give our friends in Florida and even your way there in the Carolinas a hand if it comes to that. But the storm, basically, the good thing about it, and I think the same thing with you guys and Irma, you can never be fully prepared for one of these, but fortunately, with the technology we have today and the ability to accurately forecast these events, we had several days of lead time to organize, you know, both at the local level and the state level. Our state government did a great job. Our TDEM guys, the Texas Department of Emergency Management, did a great job. And we heeded the warnings. You know, we took that stuff seriously and started at the local level planning for it. Here in San Marcos, we were afraid, depending on where the storm stalled out, there weren't really any high-pressure systems to push it one way or the other, so we just knew it was going to run out of steam. And depending on where it did that, here in San Marcos, we could have been in one of the areas that saw, you know, 20, 30 inches of rain, or we could, as luck would have it, we could have been just out of that. And that's where we found ourselves. We stood up our EOC. We upstaffed a bunch of our resources. You know, our PD went to an Alpha Bravo shift, so they had you know, everybody working 12-hour splits. And we watched it, and we watched it very closely over that weekend. And by Monday or so, it became apparent that that we weren't going to have any serious localized flooding, which is unusual for our area. The people that are familiar with San Marcos, we're in the fourth most flood-prone county in the nation. I think we're something like the 10th most flood-prone city. So we liked the fact that we dodged that bullet. And, man, we came to work Monday and started looking around at what all we could do elsewhere. And we first found an opportunity through our TIFMAS agreements to go and assist in the city of Katy. Katy had, you know, probably 50% or more of their city under, you know, I would say 2 to 6 feet of water, and no real resources. Their fire engines and their ambulances weren't high profile enough to even make local responses, let alone go out into some of the areas with deeper water. They didn't have any boats, in their local jurisdiction. So we were able to go there. We worked in Katy for a couple of days, and then our task force was reassigned to Bridge City, which is right on the Texas-Louisiana border, and they're still there. As a matter of fact, our guys, I think they're going to be demobbed on Friday and hopefully make it back home for the weekend. But they've really done a lot of good work, and not just in rescuing and emergency response. You know, it's one of those things that, you send guys that will do whatever's asked of them, and they've spent some time trying to help the community, you know, tearing sheetrock and carpet out of affected homes in between calls. They spent time searching for people's wedding rings and stuff, non-replaceable items. So it's been pretty impressive to hear a lot of the stories, not just from the guys from my organization, but friends of mine that work in other departments around the state. But the waters are receding, and I think it'll be likely be weeks or months before we really know the magnitude of the damage that's done here.
Well, I'm sure that you're probably as accurate with a month, if not really 2 months or even longer, as you begin to recover. I know that hurricanes and storms are not unique to just Texas or the Gulf Coast. They affect a lot of areas, to include the East Coast, and of course, we get some really crazy storms that hit the West Coast. So, one of the things that's happening currently is, Harvey set in Texas and did just a tremendous amount of damage, through the water and amount of rainfall that it dropped, and the creating of flooding. And the areas around Texas are somewhat similar to here in the Carolinas, as, water begins to flow towards the coastline. It's affected by the tides, and, one of the biggest things that you have is there's nowhere for it to go, especially when the front end of that is already flooded itself. So there's not an ability to pull the plug on a drain. I know last year when we had flooding, from the hurricane in this area, we talked about, if we could go out and just pull the plug in the bathtub, we could let this water drain out. But unfortunately, that's not a case. And let's talk a little bit about the importance of understanding or knowing your limitations and your training when it comes to something like this. Because working, as a firefighter and doing fire ground operations, or working and doing most of our rescues, unless you're trained in the water aspect, it's an entirely different ball game. And I know that in Texas, they're very, very strong with a lot of their training, especially from some of the training centers and the specialties that they do. So, Les, if you would, talk a little bit about the importance of having the right training, doing the right operations, especially when you're going into one of these disaster situations.
Oh, Doug, that's a great point. I grew up, as you mentioned earlier, I grew up in the Garland Fire Department. I started there when I was 18 years old, and we would watch as, these wildfires would break out around the state, and, a bunch of young guys, we wanted so bad to get deployed on those grass fires, and our fire chief never would send us. And, man, I remember getting so mad and so frustrated that he wouldn't send us. And, I didn't understand why he thought that way. And he was like, if they want somebody to go backfill their fire stations for structure fire or EMS response, man, I'll send you guys in a minute. But if they want to send people that know wildland firefighting, you guys don't have any experience at that, and you're not trained for that, then I'm not going to put you in a bad situation. And, I got the job here in San Marcos in Central Texas, and, man, these guys do grass fires. They do wildland firefighting, and I told them the first one of those I went to, just to them, a pretty small event, 150 acres or so. And they said, well, what do you think, Chief? And I said, man, if it's larger than a median, I don't know much about it. And, man, I really came to appreciate the discipline that it took for my fire chief in Garland to not put us into a bad situation. This is something, the water rescues and stuff are something we deal with. There's two rivers in our community. There are two other pretty good-sized rivers close by. And, again, we're flood-prone. It doesn't take much for us to see some swollen Rivers and them to get out of their banks in our area. So everyone on our fire department, it's part of our entrance exam that they take a swim test. We have two Zodiac rescue boats. Everybody has their own set, just like a bunker gear. They have their own set of Swiftwater gear, you know, a wetsuit, their own PP flotation device, their helmets, all their lights, everything. And so that's something we do. And when there's a call for that, I think it's incumbent upon the administrators of the organization to look and see if, hey, what they need, is that what we do? And can we really go there? Because the last thing you want to do is go and be part of the problem. You want to be part of the solution and not go there and make an already bad situation worse. And so in this case, you know, they're dealing with fast-moving water, and that's our area of expertise. That's in our wheelhouse. And even within our organization, when we were selecting people for deployment, we picked the guys that had the most exposure to using our boats and the most training with those. We sent a high-profile LMTV, a military light-to-medium tactical vehicle. We've been acquiring those for water rescues around our community. And we sent one of our battalion chiefs because he operated one of those in the military during his time there. And we wanted someone that was familiar with it. He knows how to troubleshoot it. He knows how to repair it. Again, you're not at home where you can just take everything to the shop or call the mechanic and have him come out to the fire station. A lot of that you have to depend on field repairs and the ability to really know and service your equipment. So I think you bring up a great point. It comes down to, you know, self-control and self-discipline of the people making the decisions on, hey, we're going to go. And once that decision's made, who do we send, and making sure we send people that are part of the solution and not someone that's going to get there and aggravate the problem even more.
Absolutely. And I know we got people listening. If you want to join into our conversation, be part of the show, all you have to do is dial in to 760-454-8852. That number again is 760-454-8852. We'd love to have you join in. You do bring up something, and, you know, during Harvey, one of the things I saw was on social media, people wanting to go help. And I particularly remember seeing one individual that was looking for guys and girls to get together and basically self-deploy there. And, you know, one of the things that I put out immediately to them is, like, do not self-deploy. First of all, there is a tactical mechanism that needs to be in place for experience and knowledge of how to operate in those type of conditions. Second of all, there is a strategic master plan for deployment that's going on across the United States through, you know, the statewide FEMA mobilization and USARS, and these are people that are highly and specifically trained to go do the tasks they're doing. The best thing that you can do is, you know, assist by sending supplies and things like that. Do not self-deploy. And, you know, they were trying to call the incident commander, and I'm like, you have got to be kidding me. Quit squirreling, dude. Just, you know, you don't need to be there. And he's one of what I call one of these 220s. He's got 2 years in the fire service and thinks he's got 20 years of experience, but, you know, that's a problem, and that happens in a lot of places, and it happened during 9/11 with the folks running to New York City and dumping in there, and they didn't have true accountability, and that's critical when you get into, you know, doing operations from a command level, especially on a major command function like that is in a disaster situation. But, you know, the thing about it is, those resources were, you know, being deployed appropriately. I know that we have individuals who are part of the USAR team here in the state of South Carolina, and we actually have individuals that are specific to the HART team. And, you know, one of the pictures I shared on my social media was of Captain Archibald from Horry County Fire Rescue. He was actually in the helicopter. He was, you know, out on the line, and he's pointing as they're beginning to do one of those rescues. Well, you mentioned it earlier. Everything is very specific and, you know, acclimated to your training. Now, there's not a lot of people that can go hang off of a drop line from a helicopter doing water rescues. That's just something that you don't see that much of. But, you know, you bring up the specifics, and you're right when it comes to the command officer's level of diligence to say, hey, I'm not going to send you and get you in a world of trouble. What I have to add to that comment on top of what I've just said is company officers who are on the streets, they're the actual cogs of the wheel and the gear mechanisms of making all this stuff happen, have to understand the capabilities of their people as well and make those sound decisions at a company level, not to engage in something that they can't necessarily handle. And, you know, when you get into those disaster situations, and I know that the good folks in Texas and their responders, you know, that were in Texas operating, are operating basically on their own for about 72 hours. And you've got to make some good decisions. And, you know, you operate quite frequently, and especially when you start getting some of these. How hard is it to operate for 72 hours self-sufficient?
It is incredibly difficult, and I'll tell you one of the things that that we learned the hard way in 2015. Our newest fire station was constructed in 2009, first opened in 2010. Man, it had all of the modern conveniences. You know, a big nice natural gas generator. It had an uninterrupted power supply. You know, I think it was a $150,000 bank of batteries, and it would carry us for so many hours, and then the generator would carry us for days after that. And as soon as our fire station flooded, we lost both the generator and the UPS supply. And if you want to talk about being self-sufficient, you'll learn a lot about it right then. You'll learn a lot about what it takes to, you know, to take bank chargers for your radios and put them into apparatus with onboard generators, just to be able to run the chargers so you can keep your handheld radios charged and in service. The same thing, you know, we've been seeing a little bit of a fuel shortage here locally. And, you know, do your contracts with your fuel providers, do they guarantee that they'll hold back, you know, a few thousand gallons of gas and diesel just for your emergency response vehicles? You know, we're fortunate that we have a vendor here that we worked with for many years, and they'll hold back the last 3,000 gallons of each tank just for emergency response, so police, fire, and EMS can have access to those fuels, so we can continue to do our job. You know, if you start looking at it from a, you know, we talk about being the prognosticators of doom. You know, how bad could this really get, and what could go wrong, is a pretty good way to approach these situations when you're thinking through it. One of the things that we learned, and one of our takeaways from this latest deployment, is we sent several of our company officers and battalion chiefs, and they all have purchasing cards for the city, but they're operating in an area that's without power. And so they can't use their ATM card to get cash. There's no power to that. They can't use their fuel card to get gas or fuel for the apparatus because the pumps are, you know, the card readers are down. And so one of the things that we've learned is to, you know, send them with a bank bag with some cash next time for those eventualities. So I think, you know, one thing is just like with any emergency response, when you get back, you know, sit down and make a list of all the things you learned and, you know, keep those for the next time because you're going to need them again. But being prepared, you know, having those guys leave with several changes of clothes and having those clothes in waterproof bags. You know, our guys left with their clothes. I believe they're in bags. The bags were in plastic totes. And then we sent a vehicle specifically with a large enough cab for those guys to put that in there. They were well over a week before the first opportunity to do any laundry came about. And that was working in some pretty rough areas, you know, as far as water. There's all kind of sewage and hydrocarbons and stuff that seeps into those. One of the things, you know, that we're fortunate of here is we've got some good regulations in place by the Texas Department of State Health Services and the Texas Commission on Fire Protection. But one thing that the IFF and others are championing at this time is we're going to make sure that everybody that was deployed throughout our state receives a Hep A, Hep B, and a tetanus shot if they didn't have it prior to the deployment. So there's just a lot of things to think about Before you go, one other thing we learned this time was send every vehicle with at least one extra set of windshield wipers. They've wound up left here with good ones, but man, if you run those windshield wipers 24 hours a day for 5 or 6 days straight, you wear out a pair of them pretty quickly, especially working with and around a bunch of debris. So just some things that we've taken away that we'll be able to do better next time.
Well, the windshield wipers is something that most people don't think about. But again, you're taking lessons learned, and it's just like doing a post-incident analysis and playing on it. Well, we're talking about the things that are happening in Texas, and as horrific as all that is, the United States is also beginning to, as we mentioned early on, get ready to take another on the chin hit from Irma. And depending on exactly how that storm tracks, Fort Lauderdale, Miami, South Florida, that area could take a direct impact of a Category 4 to 5 storm. Depending on how it tracks, whether it comes up through the middle of the state, for the sheer size of it, it's gonna, in Florida, it'll cover the entire state coming up, at least with hurricane force winds all the way across the state and a Category, four or five impact, and then probably a three, moving through the state until it moves off. The current track has it moving off somewhere about mid-state to, right along the Georgia-Florida border. So let's just say Cocoa Beach up to about Jacksonville, and then it makes another landfall somewhere between the upper Georgia coast, lower South Carolina coast. As the latest of, some of the projection of where that's at. But you open that cone up, and that cone of, probability could go all the way from the Outer Banks of North Carolina, all the way back down to Florida, where it come, it may not even come off. It may go up through the state of Georgia, up through the inland. It just depends on, the track that it takes and, the influences. But we're doing a lot of the prep work now and preparing. And, one of the things that, we're looking at, if it does not come on land but make that hard easterly and northeasterly turn, where I'm at here in Horry County, which is the northern coast of South Carolina, we could take an on-the-chin direct hit of a potential Category 5 storm, which is going to be devastating. And, part of what we faced over the last couple of weeks is a lot of rain. I mean, we've had a tremendous amount of rainfall. It's already saturated. My yard has got water standing in the back where it just won't drain out, where it's just that saturated. So what happens when you start getting this, or even if it hit, impacts in another area and we have high winds, you're going to get a lot of downed trees, which starts to impact your infrastructure, which changes the entire game again. Now you're running, trying to cut your way through to emergencies or whatever, and you've got power lines involved. That's a whole nother game that sometimes will influence your decision making. So I know y'all experienced a lot of that in Texas as well as they do every place else. But at this point in time, you mentioned these responders and how difficult it was on them in Texas. Now they're coming back. We're going to give them what I call the halftime break, and then they're going back. So I know you've done some deployment. I know that you've worked with, the state emergency management and some of the Texas deployment stuff. How big of an impact is this on people?
Man, it's tough. It's one of those things that I think, they're the firefighters that want to go on these deployments are typically, they're our first string guys. They're the people that you lean on in your department. The guys here in Texas that are on Task Force One, that's pulled from agencies all across our state and deploys out of College Station. Task Force Two is almost all Dallas Fire Rescue guys, and they're both excellent teams. But the guys that find their way onto those teams, and the guys that are on these SAW crews and on these different specialty teams, they're first string players, and they want to go. But what comes with that a lot of times is guys that won't quit. I saw that with my guys early on in this event, guys that I know had been up almost all weekend here at home, in anticipation. You know, we were chasing the down trees and down power lines. I think at one time we may have had, you know, 200 to 500 homes without power here in our city, and we were having to go out and help the utility companies clear trees and stuff so they could make those repairs. And those guys went back home and got about 12 hours of sleep before we started talking about ramping up for a strike team to send to Katy. And when they got to Katy, I was there and already kind of arrived ahead of them and was working with the local fire chief there to kind of get things in order and work out a game plan for how we were going to manage the next few days. And those guys got there, and I knew they were exhausted, and they wanted to go right to work. You know, they could see all the calls that we had pending, the people that were trying to be evacuated from their homes that wanted to leave and hadn't been able to because we didn't have boats, we didn't have high-profile vehicles. And as soon as we arrived with those, you know, our guys wanted to go to work with them, and it's really hard. And again, you know, it takes somebody with the self-control and the discipline to make a decision, sometimes an unpopular decision, that those guys do have to rest. They cannot work, you know, around the clock 24 hours. They've got to get something to eat. They've got to get some rest. And then back at home, you've got to try to support them here as well. You know, when I check in with my guys that are on the deployment, you know, one of the things I'm always asking them, hey, you know, how's the family doing? Is there anything we can do to support them here? I know one, just a small thing that I saw had been done. One of our guys was out of town. We've had a bunch of rain here, and grass is growing like crazy. And, you know, his yard's getting tall. His wife and three little kids, you know, they couldn't do it. And his neighbor recognized the guy's yard needed done and went over and just completely manicured it, did it up right. You know, he didn't just run over it with the mower. He weed-eated and edged it, cleaned it all up. And, man, that's a relief for those guys that are out of town, knowing that that somebody's taking care of those details at home, you know, reaching out and making sure that the families don't need anything. You know, our loved ones, our wives, our girlfriends, you know, husbands, whatever, they know our personalities, and they're used to taking care of things when we're away at the fire station for 24 hours or more. But when you take that and you drag that out for a full two-week deployment, man, that puts a lot of burden on them. And this all happened right at the time when school was starting. Our guys that were deployed, most of them missed taking their kids to school for the first day of school here. You can't get those back. But you've got to support them. You've got to encourage them. But I think you've got to look out for their own well-being, because they're going to be focused on the emergency. They're going to be focused on the problem at hand. And they need the people above them looking out for them and making sure that sometimes when they need to take a break, they're made to do so and not allowed to just push through it, which is their first inclination.
Well, and, you know, being on a response team as well in my past life with Task Force 8, which was the USAR team, one of the USAR teams in North Carolina being deployed, it does take its toll. And when you go in, you go and you go and you go, and then, you know, you come back and there's not really a break before you're having to go again at something. You know, it takes its toll. And you mentioned, you know, the clothing and everything that you go through. That's one of the things that I used to, as a company officer, used to tell our folks if we were facing something. I said, when you come in with as much stuff as you can come in with. And they would think that I was crazy when I would tell them this. But, you know, part of what you're doing is setting yourself up, because you don't know what you're going to get into. And there's nothing worse than having to put on dirty, nasty clothes to try to continue to work. And especially after you've been in them for, you know, a period of time, a shower and, you know, the opportunity to, you know, get a clean set of clothing on is just nothing more than just pure refreshment from that. Especially after you've been in it and it's muddy, it's dirty, it's wet, it's dried, and you've sweated and, you know, everything else. It's just kind of one of those things you want. So, we had checklists that we went through, you know, like X number of pair of socks, and, you know, and we did all that. But, you know, right now, you know, the United States Fire Service and emergency services overall, which is, you know, law enforcement, the emergency medical services, emergency management, you know, the fire service, the rescue services, our guard and everybody else are truly taking a beating. And that's something we need to keep in mind as well, because you know, we're the recipients of that as citizens, but also as, you know, colleagues. You know, they're coming to help us. And I know how much that state mutual aid means to us when people are deploying from, as they did last year, as we're anticipating is going to happen again this year from the upstate, when they're sending crews to help man fire engines and boat crews that are, you know, specialized in water operations and those type of things, you know, mean the world. Let's talk about this from a chief officer perspective as well, and that'll help us transition into what I've got kind of lined up for the second half of the show is how much stress do these events put on chief officers? And I know that most of the time there's a little bit of what I will call the ability to come back to the house and defuse and debrief with your crew members and the folks that are in your fire service family and, you know, be able to do that and then be able to go home and kind of get away from that, you know, on a relief. From a command officer, from an administrative level, you know, we don't necessarily go back to the station to get a chance to debrief. It's a pretty much a nonstop time period. I know that we try to work in these 12-hour rotational shifts. When you go home, a lot of times you don't get a chance to really defuse, debrief because you're late getting out of there from the transition time period. You got to be back in for a transition. You get in and you're exhausted and you go pretty much straight to bed. What do you think needs to happen? And we'll dialogue a little bit on this, Les, but how do we take care of the other side of the fence? You know, I think we do pretty good when we take care of the troops with all the things that we do with employees assistance, when we send out our firefighter assistant teams, those type of things. But when you're stuck in that EOC or you're stuck in the operations center, when you're stuck in the command role, a lot of times you don't even get a chance to see those folks. And, you know, sometimes it's difficult to try to communicate from that command thought process down to somebody that's not in the command level. And I want to get your thoughts on it, and I'm going to share some of the thoughts that I have and some of the things that have happened here in South Carolina. But I'm going to give you a chance to go first, Les.
And the one of the things you brought up was the stress of it. And I think that's one of probably the hardest things to communicate. And if you want to relate it to something that most of the folks listening to your show might be able to identify with, you know, when you're the captain or the battalion chief on a house fire, you know, you're pretty concerned about everybody that's working for you there at that event, and your blood pressure's up, your pulse is up, and you really don't relax until the fire's under control, the all clear is given, and we're kind of mopping things up, and then you kind of allow yourself to take a deep breath and, you know, let it go and feel like, okay, hey, everybody's going home. With these mobilizations, 14-day deployments, you know, your guys are out there and you know it's episodic. The work is episodic. They're not constantly in danger. But you know when they're working in areas that are destroyed like the ones we are, man, there's a lot of hazards that are ever present. There's the chemical stuff and the stuff that's in the water that could be problematic. There's the potential for electrical issues that could be problematic. You know, there's storm drains and stuff that these guys could accidentally fall into. You know, a lot of things around them. And as the chief officer, even when you do get back to the office or back home, you know, those guys aren't very far from your mind the entire time they're gone. And you really just want to be standing out on the approach when they get back and see that they're all in one piece, see that they made it home safely. You know, we care a lot about those guys. They're our biggest investment. In a lot of cases, you know, they're our friends. They're guys we've worked with, you know, for many, many years in a lot of cases. And we want them to make it back home in one piece. So that is a very stressful thing. You talked about the EOC, and I tell my guys, you know, and ours specifically is a big box that doesn't have many windows. And, you know, it's really tough as these events ramp up. We're getting most of our information from, you know, computer models and Excel spreadsheets coming out of dispatch or out of the EOC and making decisions, you know, with city management, with input from our policymakers, our elected officials. And you know at the same time that those guys and gals that work for you are out there on their apparatus delivering service to our people. And when you hear them go to certain calls, you tense up and you know, hey, this is something where they could be in danger, and you wait to hear how that's resolved to make sure that everybody, you know, gets through it okay. We had a couple of years ago in 2015, I believe, we had a lady. It was still dark. The sun hadn't come up, and a young lady had spent a good amount of time in a tree just outside of the banks of the San Marcos River, and happened to be spotted by some passersby. And we had to send a crew over, and the only way to get to her was a live bait rescue. And we put one of our senior members at the time. The guy had, I think, 31 years on the job, one of our captains, but he's also one of the swift water experts, not just in our area, but here in the state as a whole. We put him on a rope and put him basically into this river that had crested higher than it had ever been before. And I remember, you know, sitting in the EOC listening, and all I wanted to hear was that they were back and back onto the overpass. You know, they launched this rescue from an overpass that normally the water's 20 or 30 feet below it, and they were, you know, on water level on the overpass, and you want to make sure those guys get back. But you also have to think of the stress that's on the other member of their crews, the other members of their crew that are part of that rescue. And maybe they're not the one on the line, but they're the ones setting it up, and they're the ones handling and managing the riggings and stuff that those guys are operating on, and the pressure they're on. So you've got to, again, take those things into consideration. Make sure you program in adequate rest breaks for the people in the EOC or the people out in the field. You know, make sure they get some rest and they get a chance to kind of decompress before you put them back in, especially when you know it's something that's going to last multiple operational periods. Break it up into 12-hour blocks or 8-hour blocks if you have the staffing, and let them get a chance to get away from it for a little bit and get some rest, because they're going to want to go as long as you'll let them.
And, you know, that is typical of a firefighter mentality, of an emergency medical services mentality, of a law enforcement mentality. It's emergency services, period. That's how we think. That's how we're truly wired. One of the things is, that I talk about quite a bit is the amount of stress that you get to and how do you diffuse. One of the periods that our state went through is we had a lot of things that affected chief officers, and we were able to create a peer group that you could actually do counseling, or we trained them in like a stress diffusing type process through our state firefighters association, and the group that, you know, does a lot of work with them, and that's Patty Graham. Now she does a great job with our FAST team and all that training that's going on. But we created a chief officer level so that chief officers had other chief officers they could talk to that understood, you know, where they were coming from and how it was, and could help them go through, or, you know, could relate and give good advice. And you know, I think that's critical. It's very critical that we take care of that. Mental health is a big piece that goes on during responses or any time. But, you know, we're up to about halfway through the show, and, of course, I definitely want to thank the group that puts this on or allows us to put it on. So when we come back, we're going to have more with Chief Les Stevens from San Marcos, Texas, and we're going to talk about developing chief officers in the second portion of the show. So stay tuned. We'll be back right after this.
When you're not listening to Fire Engineering Talk Radio, get online to fireengineering.com and check out the Fire Engineering Network. Get the best in training, news, video, and community in the fire service today. The best source for training and information on the World Wide Web, fireengineering.com. Now back to Fire Engineering Talk Radio.
We also want to thank Honeywell for their involvement and Fire Engineering, Blog Talk Radio, and, of course, Chief Bobby Alton. But speaking of Honeywell, one of the great things they're doing, they're sponsoring an opportunity for people to go. And when I talk about sponsoring or scholarships, I'm talking about pretty much an all expense paid. They're going to pick up your cost to go to FDIC. They're going to pick up your travel and your hotel room. And all this is by Honeywell. They're doing scholarships every month. They're doing a number of these scholarships. People think it's a one-time deal and it's over. Nope. Still going on. You need to go to fireengineering.com, check it out. FDIC.com, check that out. FDIC, honestly, is not that far around the corner when you really begin thinking about it. I know that notifications have gone out about speaking at FDIC. Instructors are being said. I know that the good folks that do that back at the Pinwell office, Ginger and Diane and Bobby and all those folks are working hard to get this show to be the best show that it always is, the best show on the earth, the greatest show on earth for firefighters and emergency services coming. And it's across the world. It's international, FDIC International 2018. Can't wait to be out there. Les, I know you're going. You want to talk a little bit about what you're going to be doing at FDIC, because it's really what we're going to talk about in the second part of the show, and it's important.
Absolutely. This year I submitted a proposal for a class. I've had the privilege of being invited to speak at FDIC. I think this is my 15th, maybe even my 16th year, and I've done topics, several line of duty death things that I've been a part of, some stuff that I've kind of come up with. You know, as you mentioned earlier, my strategic decision making class at Commercial Building Fires. I did that as both a hour and 45 minute class and as a 4 hour workshop for a few years. And this year, you know, one of the things that I had been working on and I'd had an opportunity to do it locally was a class that it just seemed like there wasn't much out there on it to help our up-and-coming members who want to start to take the steps now to prepare to be chief officers, to kind of point them in the right direction, answer some of their questions. And I'm not specifically gearing that toward the fire chief, toward a five bugle chief, but even guys that are, you know, new in the service or a company officer that wants to maybe be a battalion chief or an assistant chief, and what do they need to be thinking about? What are the things they can do to prepare themselves? And then also to kind of take some of the mystery out of these processes, you know, whether it's an internal process and promoting within one's own organization or a process where, you know, they're applying to an agency that they've not previously worked for, or maybe a headhunting firm is doing the recruitment and hiring, to kind of give guys a little bit of familiarity with that. I know that's something that, for whatever reason, the guys that have some of that information aren't always so eager to share it with others. Maybe they're a little afraid of some good competition or something. And I was invited to do that for a group up in Dallas a year or so ago. A buddy of mine named Scott Roseberry from Garland invited me to do it for a group of battalion chiefs. And I took that opportunity, and man, it went really well. That rolled into doing it for our Texas Fire Chiefs Academy, which is put on by our Texas Fire Chiefs Association twice a year. And again, it was received really well. And I thought, you know, maybe there's more people out there looking for this information than I thought, and submitted it to Fire Engineering. And lo and behold, I was lucky enough, fortunate enough for Diane and Bobby and the Pinwell Advising Board to pick it up and give me an opportunity to present it. I'll be doing it on Monday as a four-hour workshop this year at FDIC, and I'm really excited about doing it. Each one of these classes is different from the last, because it's really geared toward what the people in the seats want to discuss, and I let them make a list of items at the beginning of the class, and man, we just work our way through them, and it's more of a discussion than it is lecture. There's no PowerPoint. It's all pretty fast-paced exchanging of ideas and experiences in hopes that that some people can take away some things and remove a little bit of that mystery from moving in, moving from company officer ranks into chief officer ranks, and then eventually on to the fire chief's chair, if that's what they aspire to do.
I tell you what, let's dive in a little bit here. You sparked my interest, and I think people would like to know. You said you did this program at the Texas Fire Chiefs Academy. Talk a little bit about what the Texas Fire Chiefs Academy is.
Okay, yeah, man, I think we're going into our 8th year, maybe more. Robert Isabel, who is the chief in Round Rock now, was the chief in Midland at the time that he served as the president of the Texas Fire Chiefs Association. At the time, our current state fire marshal, Chris Keneally, who was working in Cedar Park, had a vision. You know, we always talk about and we beat ourselves up. I won't say we get beat up. We beat ourselves up. We are the fire service. We can't blame someone else. But that we don't prepare a guy when we promote him to company officer. You know, we don't prepare him for that role. When we promote him to chief officer, we don't prepare him for that role. And I think that's something that we're doing a much better job of. There's a lot of programs out there that address that. But one of the voids that Chief Keneally and Chief Isabel saw was something geared specifically toward future chief officers or current, you know, incumbent chief officers. And they put together a 2-year program. It meets 1 week, and then 6 months later it meets another week. You can either take both sections in 1 year or you can span it out over 2 years, and it moves around the state to kind of make it convenient for different people. And it is, as I've described it to my officers, it's a 10,000 foot overview of all of the things that a chief officer needs to be aware of. And keeping in mind that fire chiefs, at least in my experience, the ones that have been successful aren't specialists. They're generalists. They're not very heavy in one area, but they've done a lot of different things, and they typically have a pretty extensive list of professional contacts, and this helps in a lot of those areas. It helps to help our company officers and our young battalion chiefs, assistant chiefs. It helps them to broaden their network by putting them in a room with, you know, 20, 30, 40 other people similarly situated to them from around the state of Texas. It gives them about a week. They really get to know each other, get pretty comfortable expressing their ideas. And at the same time, it's a very fast-paced program. We talk about everything from our Texas Commission on Fire Protection, the regulatory agency that we operate under here in Texas. We talk about legal considerations. We talk about TIFMAS, our Texas Interstate Fire Mutual Aid System. We talk about motivation. We talk about line of duty deaths. You know, just all kinds of different things. One section deals specifically with designing and administering the process of constructing a new fire station. And so it really gives a lieutenant, a captain, somebody that's looking up and thinking, hey, is that for me? It gives them a little bit of a glimpse of what they'd be getting into when they leave that fire engine or that fire station and move into more of an administrative role in their organization.
Well, you know, one of the things that we've been working on here in South Carolina is increasing the amount of education that's out there for a chief officer level. So I did hit you up and say, hey, send me, you know, kind of an outline, a curriculum style thing of what's going on there in Texas. And I know that they bring in guest speakers from, you know, various different places as well to share additional information or their expertise with folks. So if you get a chance to go out there and work in one of these or attend one of these programs, you'll learn a lot about what's going on in Texas, but you're also going to get a big overview of some other things. And I challenge other state chiefs associations to take some of the approaches that we are and follow in the footsteps of what Texas does to build. And when you threw out less about being a generalist rather than, you know, being a specialist, one of the things that I know we've dialogued about in the past and we know is very important is in the development of people, it's more than just one thing. And that's one of the things that I know that you focus on in the class. And, you know, in development, it takes training. It takes certifications. It takes education. But it also takes having those self-development components that are in there. It also takes having experiences, taking all that stuff, and I call it building a good stool. And the way that I put this is I build a three-leg stool that had many components just like a stool does. First of all, if you're going to rest your career, you know, on what you've accomplished, then that's the seat, and that's where you have to sit. And those legs have to support your weight. And your weight could be, you know, however much based on what you're facing in your role as a chief officer or as an officer, period, as you, and this goes for any rank as you're developing. But the one leg is the training and the certifications, those type of things. When you get over to a second leg, it's education. And I call it formalized education. And this Texas Fire Chiefs program is one of those formalized educations. Everybody jumps on the degree program. Oh, it's a degree, it's a degree, it's a degree. Well, pretty much in today's fire service, you're looking at degree programs, but it's much more than that. The education that you get is more than just the tactical or the skills or things. It takes you to a different level, just like what you were describing. The third leg of that stool is basically your self-development, what you've done to help develop yourself. In other words, what have you went out and been able to go do, attend, whatever. That's kind of the kicker. Now, what I do is I recognize that you don't get anywhere, and you said this about the networking. You don't get anywhere without networking, good coaches, and good mentors. And most stools, if you look at them, have members that tie legs together or the support beams that go across. And most of the time, there's multiple levels of those. So you may have multiple mentors. You may have multiple coaches. Those mentors may be at different levels. And, you know, with all that, you know, you begin, you know, solidifying these legs to be solid for you to, you know, put that seat upon. Because it's already attached. That's where you're going to sit, but you don't want them collapsing on you. Well, I found that, you know, if you go in there and you tie a nice piece of wood that's solid all the way across or make what would look like a shelf on each one of those cross members, which is the mentoring and the coaching, and you put experiences, the things that you experienced. And many people don't recognize that the experiences outside the fire service and in fire service organizations or other organizations, and I use myself as an example, for like the ISFSI or the Southeast Association of Fire Chiefs, the State Association of Fire Chiefs, those type of things, and the experiences you get from those, coupled with the experiences that you get from the field, help build this program that you're talking about and some of the things that you're sharing. Well, what I just described to you was developing the next generation of fire service leaders, which I'll be doing at FDIC, which is on a Tuesday. So I'm inviting everybody to go meet with Chief Stevens on Monday, come over to my program on Tuesday. We're both going to try to pop in and out of each other's rooms so that we can actually share and give the education levels that is demanded at the FDIC. Chief Alton demands that level of education to the people because it's about servant leadership. And when we're there instructing, it's about giving to people. It's about serving the people that are in your classes. And I want you to continue on some of your thought process here, Chief, of what else do we need to be doing for the people that we're developing?
Man, I think you touched on it, and I think it's good to hear, you know, kind of the way you're approaching that. With the stool, I've got a similar approach, but they're different enough that if guys came to both of our classes, I still think they'd be able to get something out of it. And, you know, you touched about FDIC. One of the things I like about teaching at FDIC is I know the caliber of the other instructors, and I know that they're all going to put in, you know, countless hours preparing their topics, doing their research, and being as prepared as they absolutely can. You know, 35,000 people in Indianapolis at one time, all there to recharge their batteries and gain information to take back and share is pretty energizing for me. And I've always thought myself fortunate to be able to be a part of that. The class that I do touches a little bit on what you said, you know, the education, the certification, and the experience. And one of the things that you briefly touched on, if I could maybe drive a little deeper into it, is, you know, experience at the chief officer level isn't all about, you know, calls that you made on the fire engine responding code 3. At that level, you know, I get opportunities. I had a buddy of mine from Longview today reached out to me, and he's looking for a captain or a battalion chief to come and sit on an assessment center there for his promotional process. You know, there's an experience that will help you down the road. Being on your department's interview panel when they're hiring new employees or being a part of the background process will help you as you progress throughout your career. Being involved in speccing and ordering, you know, fire apparatus or designing and building a fire station will help you when you move away from something that is strictly emergency response driven and into an administrative role. Having had some exposure to those things throughout your career will be helpful. You know, not very many people get them, but having an opportunity, as different states handle it different ways, but having an opportunity to participate and conduct and even deliver a line of duty death investigation, that's something we all dread. But I promise you, nothing will make you take as critical a look at yourself and your department as investigating a tragedy in someone else's. And we do that with all the utmost respect for our lost brothers or sisters. But at the same time, if we're being honest with ourselves, we're doing it to look for ways to make ourselves and our departments and other departments better and hopefully prevent that from happening to someone else. So I think those experiences aren't all tied up in emergency response. There's a lot of other things that someone could and should be exposed to along the way that will help prepare them. You know, one of those is teaching, something that you and I are both passionate about. You know, if you look back over my career, it's something I really enjoy doing as I've promoted. It seems like each promotion brings less and less time to write articles or to travel around and teach, and FDIC still gives me that opportunity. But it's something I'm really passionate about. It's something I enjoy doing. But as we know, anything that you teach a class on, if you're really a professional about it and you take it serious, you'll study it and you'll know it as best as anyone. And then presenting it, you learn even more. You learn from the people you're instructing. You learn from people offering you input or constructive criticism. And it makes you better. You know, it sharpens your skills as well. So I encourage people to look for other opportunities to develop themselves as they look toward that next rank. In my class, one of the things we talk about is succession planning. And I know one of the jokes that you and I shared when we were beating up ideas for NFA papers, you know, for the FO program, if you go to the Learning Resource Center and you run a query for papers on basically succession planning and in any way you want to frame that, it's probably one of the most written about topics there. And we kind of talk about in my class that, you know, you may have a succession plan in your organization, but if the guy in the fire chief seat's a young guy and he's successful and there's someone about his age across the hallway that's an assistant chief, what you might be doing, although you're developing someone and preparing them to be a fire chief, you may be preparing them to be a fire chief in someone else's organization. And there's nothing wrong with that. You might not always get to pick the fruit, you know, from your own tree. Timing plays a large role in that, and people's careers take them in different directions. You know, I know people that thought they would be somewhere for 5 years and were gone in just a few months. I know people that thought they would be somewhere only 2 or 3 years and wound up staying a decade or more. So succession planning, I think, is as much about the individual and their own development as it is about the organization being able to pick and groom and develop their next leader. That may not be the case, but what you have to hope is if we're all doing this and we're all investing in our personnel, maybe somebody across town or even in a different state is developing your next battalion chief or assistant chief or fire chief. So we talk a little bit about that. We talk about the size of organizations. One of the questions that a lot of guys have, one of the things that really differentiates organizations around the country is, you know, volunteer, combination, career, and then the size. How many stations or how many square miles are protected or how many runs they make. A person that grew up in a one-station fire department isn't going to be successful, although they might aspire to have a chance to be the fire chief of, you know, the Dallas Fire Department. They're not going to be successful making that big of a jump at one time. They're going to have to gradually get there. And so we break down, you know, those stations. Typically, you know, 1 to 3 stations is pretty good. If a guy's run successfully a 1 to 3 station fire department, it's likely he could move to a station, you know, with as many as 7 to, stations, 7 to 11, probably interchangeable as well. And if a guy's run a department with 7 to 11 stations, been successful, got some experience, he might be able to move up to a metro-sized department. But you want to set some realistic expectations and not have someone go out and apply for a job in a metro department thinking that, hey, you know, my experience in this 1 or 2 station department somehow translates any more than a guy taking a job from a metro, you know, a guy that was an assistant chief in a metro-sized organization moves to a 1 or 2 or 3 station department. A lot of times they're not successful. It's two completely different organizations. The support structure that they had in their metro department, they won't find that a lot of times in a smaller organization. And a lot of the things that they had people to manage small pieces of that that larger organization in a smaller organization, that may fall to just 2 or 3 people in the administration. So I think it's good to make sure people have realistic expectations and understand the relationships of those departments. You know, one guy I know moved from a pretty small department to a mid-sized department, you know, 10, 15 fire stations. And one of the things that they struggled with initially was just in how to get his message out to a larger organization. In his previous department, he was able to go around and see the guys on a pretty regular basis, face-to-face, meet them for coffee. You know, you get to 10, 15 fire stations, even if you went to every station, you know, every morning, it's still a month and a half to make the rounds. And that's something that, again, if you haven't been there and tried to figure out how to disseminate and communicate information in a larger organization, you know, that might be troubling for you in a smaller organization, and vice versa. Another thing that we talk about is looking at the job posting and developing the resume, developing the cover letter. It's amazing how honest an organization, whether they're hiring and managing a process through their own human resources department, or if they've hired a professional firm, you know, like Affion or SGR or something like that, it's amazing how honest they will be in their job posting. And people need to look at it and not just get fixated on the idea that they're going to be a battalion chief or an assistant chief or a fire chief, but look at what they're asking for. And be honest with yourself. Do you really fit, you know, the qualifications? And look at the challenges that they're facing. And are those things that you're really prepared to step up and manage? Because you'll find in those things a lot of little pearls of wisdom and insight into what they're looking for. And then crafting the cover letter to answer how do your experiences and your background, your education, how do they line up and appear to be a good match for what that organization is looking for? And then on the resume, you know, I get asked to review a few resumes throughout the year. I see a lot of good ones, and I see some that aren't so good. But one of the things that strikes me a lot of times is you don't have to restate all the basic qualifications. You know, if you had a class 30 years ago on you know, how to set up a landing zone for a medical helicopter is probably not something that you need to include in your resume for a five-bugle chief position. You're not going to be asked to do that, but it's amazing how many guys, again, no ill intent, but they don't know any better. And that's what this class is designed to do, is hopefully give them an opportunity to ask some questions, to show them what some resumes look like from people. I've been very fortunate. A lot of my friends have agreed to let me use their resume unedited, hand them out to these guys so they have a template. And that's something that a lot of guys haven't had before. Maybe they're not comfortable asking, their chief of their department, or they don't even have a network immediately available to them to reach out to get this information. It makes it readily available, gives them some ideas of what works or what has worked, and they can go back and start to do that. Another big thing that we touch on, and you touched on it briefly as well, Chief, was the education. Man, you can't wait until you're an assistant chief and the fire chief's at HR turning in his paperwork to start preparing yourself to be the fire chief, especially in the realm of formal education, college, you know, whether it's an associate's, a bachelor's, or a master's degree. More and more, an associate's won't get you there. A bachelor's is the minimum. And a lot of departments are actually requiring, if they're not requiring, they certainly prefer a master's degree. A lot of cities now look to that EFO designation and want to see that you've either completed or enrolled in the EFO program, which requires in and of itself a bachelor's degree just to apply and be accepted now. So, one of the things I tell guys is you've got to start laying that groundwork probably a decade or more before, 4 years for the FO program, 4 years for a bachelor's degree, and a year or two of life in there somewhere along the way. If you really see yourself wanting to end your career at the upper ranks of your organization or another organization, you have to really decide that nowadays. You have to decide that about the middle or the end of the early part of your career in order to be able to adequately prepare and be competitive. There's great websites out there that people can go to and look at job postings for a lot of different municipal jobs. I know our state has a service where guys can see that. You know, Strategic Government Resource out of the Fort Worth area has an excellent website for people to go and look at. And I encourage guys, hey, just look at it today and then forecast where you think how many years before you think you want to be a fire chief. And what do you think those qualifications and requirements are going to be then? And develop a pursuit angle that gets you there in time to get there and still enjoy a good 5+ year run as the fire chief if that's what you want to do.
Well, you know, when you said succession planning, you may be setting a succession plan or developing somebody for another department. I came out of Chapel Hill, North Carolina, and one of the things that Chief Dan Jones did was in his 20 years of being the fire chief is he produced 6 fire chiefs that came out of there and a multitude of other people that went on to do higher level programs and positions within organizations to include being a state training director, also being a fire marshal and just things like that people went on to do out of that organization. But when you think about it and you produce 6 fire chiefs in 20 years, you're producing one about every pretty much, about 3.5 years. And, that's pretty impressive, when you think about it and the development and, he's one of these individuals that actually is traveling around now doing a lot of the coaching and the mentoring to other people and other organizations and even state chiefs associations. So, that stuff is important. All that you're talking about, all that I've got in my program, what you've got in your program, what's going on at the FDIC, what a lot of people are doing is critical to the future of the fire service. And that's one of the things that we wanted to point out in this show is how critical it is to be at that leadership level. And I tied, current events to that. And you brought out a lot about decision-making, about the stresses, about what it takes to operate, on a daily basis, much less in a disaster situation. And we've kind of coupled current events that's going on in the world today and what's going to be fresh for probably, the next 3 to 6 months as, people are recovering from all these activities. And, honestly, with what happened, in the coastal areas of Texas, what's going to happen with Hurricane Irma, we could be seeing those effects for well into a couple of years as the recovery continues. But, I want to throw out, Les, just how much of a pleasure it is to have you as a colleague and a friend. And, and how much I respect the work that you're doing as an instructor and what's going on in Texas and the things that you're sharing. So my encouragement to you is don't stop. You're making a difference, and I know sometimes that you don't see that every day, but trust me, from the outside looking in, you're making a huge difference. So as we're closing out the show here, I want to give you an opportunity to give any final comments that you've got on your mind.
Man, I sure appreciate it, and as always, I appreciate the opportunity to come on and spend some time with you. One thing for your listeners that I would close with, we've talked about FDIC, and we've talked about how it's given each of us a platform, to share our information, with the fire service. Man, I want to encourage anybody that's listening that has an idea for a class or a class that they're doing locally that's been well received. Man, don't be afraid to submit that idea to FDIC as soon as 2018's over. Bobby and Diane will push out the invitation for papers. And, man, everybody starts from scratch, and nobody gets a guaranteed slot. And one of the things that I try to do, the guys that I mentor and that call me, man, I try to encourage them to put in. And, one of these years, what's going to happen, and, I hate to say I'm excited about it, but in a way I am. One of these years, one of those guys is going to get picked up, and I won't. Right now some of them are getting picked up. People I've worked with on their topics or provided a little, encouragement to are getting picked up. But there's going to come a day when they're the guys that people are going to see, and you and I are back to just attending and watching, our handiwork and those guys taking this to a whole nother level. And, man, that excites me. I don't look at it as a competition. Those guys, if they've got better information, I want them to share it with the fire service. If it's more current information, I want that to be what's out there, because I send guys to FDIC, and I want them to get the best that they can out of that. And I think, that's a great program and a great opportunity where everybody has to submit every year, and they pick the best of the best. But I do want to encourage people who have an idea, man, just keep working on it. Write an article. Try to get it submitted. Reach out to someone and get it submitted. I know recently, Doug, I worked with you. A friend of mine had a topic that wasn't really my area of expertise, and I still wanted to help him and encourage him. And one of the things that I did was to put him in touch with you, and you worked on it with him, and I think turned it into something where he got it published. And he's going to submit it to FDIC in the future. So, that would be my thing. And my final thought is to encourage the people in the fire service that are listening to these programs that have something that is current and is good information that they're well-versed in to take a shot at it and turn in a proposal. And if you don't get accepted the first year, try again. I didn't get accepted the first time. It takes it takes constantly, knocking on that door, but they'll get there. And I appreciate, once again, you having me on here. It's always a pleasure just to visit with you and catch up. And I appreciate everything you do for the fire service. I know you're one of the busier guys out there, and we really appreciate all the time and effort that you devote to our profession and the impact that you're having as well.
Well, I certainly appreciate that, and I appreciate you being on the show. And just to add on to what he was saying, there are a lot of ways to get published with Fire Engineering. There is the website that they're always looking for content on. There is the Fire Engineering magazine that they're looking for content. There's also the Fire Rescue magazine that they're looking for content. The websites, for Fire Nation, the community. There's a lot of ways to get your information into the hands of the Fire Engineering group. And I highly encourage you to send, what you have. Take time, write it, send it to somebody, let them review it. I can promise you that Diane and those folks are good to work with. They'll help you out. They'll send you suggestions back. They'll help you get it right. And if you got a good message, they definitely want it, and they want to be the leader in education. They've been known as the leaders in education for, well over 100 years. So we definitely are appreciative to what Fire Engineering has done for the profession all these years, and what they continue to do, and how they diversify, touching the audiences through Blog Talk Radio, through websites, through blogs, through the magazines, you know, through FDIC, the things that, you know, are very, very important to our profession. But as we begin to close, one of the things that I just want to recap us with is there's a lot going on in our fire service today, from emergency responses to structural-related fires to technical rescues to hazardous materials to weapons of mass destruction to natural disasters to developing people professionally when it comes to leadership, when it comes to any aspect about our job. And part of what we want you to do is be engaged. Be part of the solution, not part of the problem. And, you know, that's what this show is dedicated to. It's about the men and women that are in a profession doing the job every day, making sure that they have the most current and up-to-date information, the cutting-edge technology, the cutting-edge knowledge to be able to do an effective and efficient job providing the services to our valued customers, which are internal to our organization as well as external. And ultimately, I will say this, and I'm an advocate for the National Fallen Firefighters Foundation, for everyone goes home. It's about everyone going home, and that's important. And as our responders across the nation are faced with a very daunting task and some challenging obstacles that are going to be in the way with the wake of Hurricane Harvey that has occurred out in the Texas area, to the face that we're facing with Irma in Florida and all the way up and down the East Coast, we want everyone to go home and stay safe. Chief, thank you for being on the show with me. I look forward to catching up with you real soon. Hopefully it's before FDIC and we get a chance to be together. But always, again, I cherish you as a valued colleague and a friend, and appreciate you being on the show. To our listeners, stay tuned. We got another episode coming up in about 6 weeks. You don't want to miss what's next on Fire and Training, and also all the other good Blog Talk Radio shows that are on the Fire Engineering Blog Talk Radio. Till next time, stay safe. We want to thank Honeywell and all that they're doing for us and Fire Engineering. Remember, FDIC.com to go check out how to get your scholarship for Honeywell. Until the next time, stay safe and make sure everyone goes home. Have a good evening.